Good morning and welcome to WHTC Money Matters with your hosts, Kerry Cooley and Jack Godfrey from the Cooley Godfrey Investment Group of Zealand. The opinions voiced in this show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial advisor, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. And now, WHTC Money Matters.
Hey, good morning, Holland, Zealand. This is Kerry Cooley calling you from a different studio this morning. He's just calling you from my home this morning on this cold, blustery, snowy morning. Man, I'm surprised, Chris, you made it into the studio. So
I barely did. I'll tell you what, it took me a while to get out of my apartment complex, and I'd seen some other people that had just given up and went. Some people just gave up on their cars, locked the doors, and went home for the night because there was cars scattered all over the parking lot, but I made it in.
Good for you. Hey, yeah, I know. Out by us, too, near Over Isle here, just I know our driveway and road and our neighbors, too, drifted shut, and it's, I mean, I was out shoveling for a while, and I know our neighbor will come and plow here in a little bit. But, yeah, there's a lot of snow out there this morning. So I'm sure everybody's warm, has turned the channel to 1450. And if you want to call in with questions, the number here is 395-1450. And today we're going to be talking about finding old money. But first, a little market update and recap. As, you know, the news has, you know, nobody can deny it or ignore it. You know, the market had its biggest decline in a long, long time, and now all the doomsayers are coming out, and the news media needs to talk about, so they use words like rough end, or is this the market, is it a big sell-off, is it a correction? We're hearing all those words come out right now, and basically, when you step back, what's happening is the Federal Reserve is still going to ease on the bond buying, which a lot of analysts, including myself, believe that that has been built into the market already. Another thing that's happening out there is some earnings of companies have come in a little bit below than expectations, but still have beaten the previous year. So what you have is people out there saying, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Company, you need to make this, and if you don't, you know, market beats them up a little bit. So a lot of this is based on speculation and other things, and we need to step back and take a look at the facts. The other thing that's happening out there is the ease and the slowing of growth in China. So what you get is some people selling things off here in the U.S. to pay for things that they own in China and some of the changes in markets over there. And this is all going to level out and should be okay. I mean, most analysts are saying that this isn't the big correction coming, but a little breather, and that things should be good and steady going forward. So that's some of the news nationally. You know, when you look out there on a Michigan basis, there's a lot of positive news happening in Michigan. If you just go out there and look, you know, there's things that business leaders in Michigan are saying that they met this past week in Detroit and saying Michigan's moving, you know, good into recovery. Meyer and Chrysler are hiring more workers here in Michigan. Meyer is actually planning to hire 4,400 part-time workers in Michigan and in other states. This is the talk that's nationally out there about the new higher minimum wage. And that is being brought up here in Michigan also. So, you know, there's a lot of things happening. Detroit, you know, we hear a lot of news about Detroit, the bankruptcy, but they're also seeing a big rise in businesses that are starting to pop up. And then Michigan also says that the universities here in Michigan are producing more entrepreneurs faster than the national average. So we have to take some of the bad news and some of the good news, and it all levels out. And sometimes we can focus so much on the bad news. Now, if we look at the market from, and this is the week ending on January 22, you know, just in a week's time, we've seen the market pull back a little over 2%. But up until January 22, we've seen, if you still look back over the past 12 months, the past year, the market is still showing in large, mid, and small growth areas, you know, 27, 26, 28, 25% return in all these areas and above. And the markets that are probably down the most over the past year has been the emerging markets. Like I mentioned earlier, China is down. So those are some things on a national basis. If we look at some of the things like what we call by the numbers, and we look at some of the averages that are out there, the average total return of Standard & Poor's 500 stocks over the last 50 years has been 10%. And if you look at the index's performance over the last 30 years, 18 has been above average and 12 have been below average. So we are always going to have up days and up years and some that are down. Also, the Standard & Poor's, those top 500 companies, which are like Coca-Cola, Philip Morris, you got companies in there like, you know, Clorox and Caterpillar. Had those reports for the fourth quarter of 2013, for the full year corporations that make up the S&P 500, that total over $99.42 per share, which is basically an all-time inflation-adjusted year-end record. So companies out there are making money. They're reporting great earnings, and people are still saying, oh, the market's overpriced. Well, Jack and I have mentioned this before. If you go out there and look at the average valuations of companies is right around 17. And if you look at the historical average of companies' valuations, it's actually a little bit higher than that. So are company valuations overvalued? No, they're right in line with averages that are out there. In 2003, 2008, when we had some of the big collapses of the tech industry and then the housing in 08, then we've seen a lot of stocks that were overvalued. We're not seeing that today. There's other things that are affecting the market. We talked a little bit about pushing the average worker hourly rate up. You know, American hourly increased a 1.9% per year for the last 5 years. And then if you look at that compared to inflation, it's been 2.1% per year. So increases in wages haven't quite kept up with inflation.
Hey, Kerry.
Yes.
We can go ahead and take our first break if it's okay with you.
Hey, that sounds great. Hey, listeners, we are listening to WHCC Money Matters. This is Kerry Cooley. The number here to call in is 395-1450. Take your questions. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back, listeners. This is WHTC Money Matters. This is your host, Kerry Cooley. And actually, Jack Hess is off in Lansing today. He's taking in actually two activities at the Michigan State University. He did a basketball game today and actually took in the hockey game last night. So we need to give him a little bit of a hard time about that. He's getting the day off from the show here. But listeners, thanks for joining us today on this cold, wintry, snowy morning here. The number to call in is 395-1450. Love to take your calls, any questions you have, and talk about questions. I thought we'd roll right into some of the questions of the week. We always try to take a Social Security question from one of our listeners that has either written in or emailed or called us even. And if you'd like to call us with any of your questions, the number at our office is 931-1223. Or you can shoot us an email. The email address is Cooley Godfrey. That's KOELEGODFREY at LPL.com. Cooley Godfrey at LPL.com or 931-1223 is our phone number. And you can reach us right now on the lines that are open at 395-1450. So here's our first question from the week. Joe has written in. Can I apply for retirement and disability at the same time? And that's a great question, because a lot of people think, well, if I'm retiring, I get Social Security, or I get one or the other. Actually, in this case, yes, when you apply for Social Security benefits, you can do this online, or you can call the local office and get an appointment. The Social Security benefit application that you'll go through establishes a claim for retirement insurance benefits, spouse's benefits, and disability and benefits. So it looks at all those things, and it becomes a valid application for all benefit types for which you are eligible. And then to complete that process of filing for disability benefits, a person must also complete the adult disability report online, and then they also need to authorize the release of their medical records. So there is some information that you need, Gang, but can you apply for retirement and disability benefits at the same time? Absolutely. You just need to go through the proper steps online, or, again, you can go to the local Social Security office. But please, as when we've talked to people from Social Security, call to schedule a time. If you walk in and just try to get a sit down with somebody, you know, everybody has an appointment, will go before you, and you could be waiting around for quite a while. So call in always if you want to sit down with somebody in person. But the people there are more than willing to help you out and go through all this. So great question written in from Joe. Another question here. Let's see here. The question is, I am trying to convince my daughter to open a 529 plan for her son. So my first grandbaby. So we have a grandpa talking about her grandson and basically saying, hey, I'd like you to open a 529 plan. And she's unsure whether or not he will actually go to college. Although she plans on it, but you never know. Can my daughter take the contributions out anytime for any reason without paying taxes or getting a penalty? Well, that's the unique thing about the 529 plan, and what goal and what it's designed for is to be a college savings plan. So when money is put into this plan, the good thing about this is it stays in the control of the owner, which is usually a parent or grandparent, and the beneficiary is the child. So even when the child turns 18, they don't get control of it. However, as the question is asked, if you go to take this money out and use it for college, whether it be room, board, tuition, anything associated with college expenses, it can be a four-year college, it can be a two-year technical school, it can be a community college, it can be anything above high school that counts as education, a computer that you're using. You can take money out of this college 529 plan, and it's tax-free. The earnings are tax-free. However, if the money's taken out of this college 529 plan and it's not used for any qualifying expenses for college, the earnings will be taxed, and there will be a penalty on top of that. So that's the one thing you have to remember. Now, there are some strategies. So let me give you some examples, listeners. In a case like this, let's say my wife and I have 529 planned for our boys, which we do. And let's say neither one of them goes to college, and we can change that beneficiary on the 529 plan from our oldest to our youngest. We can shift money that way. So if our oldest doesn't go and our youngest goes, the youngest can use it all. We can take it out and it's tax-free. Neither one goes to college. Strategy out there is to change the beneficiary to Kim or I. And in this case, what would happen is that both Kim and I in our professions are required to do continuing education every year. So we could take money out of that, pay for our continuing education classes, and it would be tax-free. So there are some, I don't want to say loopholes, there's strategies out there that you can apply. Now, I could even take it a step further. Let's say Kim and I don't use it. I could change the beneficiary to a nephew. I have a nephew in Arizona, three nephews actually. and I could change it to them, and they could take it out tax-free. Now, there would be some kind of arrangement where my brother would say, hey, we'll give you the money. That way you give us the 529 plan, comes out tax-free without penalty, so you'd be saving on the taxes and a penalty. So there definitely are strategies to work with this. I think the 529 plan is a great way to save for college, where parents, grandparents, even the child themselves can put money into it, saving for college. Last question here. The last question for the week was written in, and this question comes from Emily. Emily has written in, can I contribute to both a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA in the same year? Did the amount change this year? Well, yes, you can contribute to both, provided that the total amount that you contribute does not exceed the maximum you can put in. So, for example, if you're age 50 and younger, you can put in $5,500. So that means in this question, if you put $5,500 into Roth, you put zero into an IRA. If you put $2,500 into a Roth, you can put $3,000 into an IRA and not go over the total of $5,500. The other thing is, if you're age 50 and above, the government does allow a catch-up of you being able to put in an extra $1,000, so for a maximum of $6,500. Now, let's say you're working for an employer and you have a 401k plan there, and you're putting money in pre-tax, you're allowed to put money into that 401k plan, and you can maximize the amount that you put into a Roth IRA. So one is pre-tax, one is after-tax. Consult with your financial advisor, your CPA, as to what is going to be the best strategy for you. But great question. Yes, you can put money into both. You just cannot exceed the max. So great questions. If you'd like to call in with questions today, numbers 395-1450.
Carrie, we can take our second break now, too.
All right. Sounds good, Chris. Listeners, we'll be right back. The number here is 395-1450. I know you guys are out there sitting by your radio's listening here on this day, probably not outside much. So, hey, we're going to take a short break to listen to WHTC Money Matters. This is Kerry Cooley. Hey, welcome back, listeners. You're listening to WHTC Money Matters. This is your host, Kerry Cooley. And I hope that everybody's staying in with a warm cup of hot chocolate and snuggled up next to the fireplace. But thanks for listening.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah.
We had a caller during the break. Can you take a question?
I certainly can.
All right. This is all the information we have, so it might not be enough to answer. But Bruce in Holland was wondering, if you max out your 401k and you still have extra funds, what do you recommend doing with those funds?
That's a great question from Bruce. So if he maximizes his 401k, he can still go out, and if he thinks of putting money away for retirement, one idea would be to, he could put away and maximize out his Roth IRA. Now, if Bruce is under 50, he can put $5,500 into a Roth IRA. And if he's over 50, he could put $6,500 into a Roth IRA. Now, he's allowed to maximize the 401k, and he's allowed to maximize the Roth. Now, that's just one idea. Two other ideas, and I know the list could go on from there. Another idea for Bruce is, what is he doing as far as, does his, if he's married or not married? If he's married, does his wife have a 401k or another type of retirement plan, a Roth IRA? He could also contribute to his spouse's retirement IRA or Roth IRA, but again, it's maximized by age. And another option is, if he needs the money liquid or needs it in a case of emergency, you know, there are cases where he may just want to put in a savings or a short-term CD, but those aren't paying much right now. So what it boils down to is, what is the goal that Bruce has with this money? What are his specific goals? What's unique to him? Those are just some ideas. But definitely Bruce would want to sit down with his financial advisor to discuss what is a good strategy for some of this money. You know, and it depends on how old Bruce is, his goals. Those are all variables in there. So there'd be a lot of other questions to ask. But great question. Those are some general ideas. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about what we call finding old money and some stories that I like to share. I just had one of these happen this past week where a couple of mine, the husband passed away, and they've been clients for over 20 years, and they happened to, or she did, the surviving spouse happened to find old stock certificates of a local company in their safety deposit box that she never knew about. And people kind of sometimes wondering, well, are these worth anything? What should I do with them? Well, first thing you usually want to do with those is, you know, make sure that you keep them in a safe place and take copies of them. And you can come into a financial institution like ours, and we can help do some research to find out whether these old stock certificates are worth anything. Sometimes it could be as simple as they were in a safety deposit box for many years and it's a good company of Coca-Cola or Consumers Power, and these companies are still in business, and it's just a matter of re-registering those stocks in the proper name of the rightful owner. You know, those are some things. In other cases, a client of mine a number of years ago had worked for U.S. Air many years ago, had received stock certificates for compensation and bonuses throughout her years, and then had stored these in her safety deposit box, but then the company, U.S. Air, actually went bankrupt, and those people that had these stock certificates received a new replacement stock certificate and a value that was a lot less. Well, this person had forgot about the stock certificates in their safety deposit box or their safe at home. The children found them many years later. And, you know, how do you find out whether something like that's worth anything? Something like that is, again, we deal with it every day, and I know people out there wouldn't know where to start, but something like that, again, you want to go to a financial advisor where we could research, re-register those. We would have to have a death certificate in cases like this. And actually, there was some value out there that was found in some of these cases. You know, so what do you do with these old stock and bond certificates that you may find in a parent or grandparent safe? You know, even if the company is worthless, the actual stock certificate is worth something to collectors. So, you know, it may not be worth much, but I have some old stock certificates that I have collected. Just, they have holes punched in them. They're of no value in the sense of the company being in business, but collectors like to collect them like people collect postage stamps or collect coins. There's a value out there sometimes to collectors, and we can connect you with companies that actually buy and sell old stock certificates like this. You know, sometimes some go for upward to $10. I've even seen some old collectibles, because they're very rare, go up to $10,000, and the average seems to be about $100 to $200 just from a collector standpoint. You know, certificates can also be, in the case, legal, meaning they're issued to a person, or sometimes old stock certificates can be what they call, and I have some of these myself, is a specimen. It's the, like the first stock certificate that's printed by off the press, but it's just a test run, and it's a sample copy. And then you also have old stock certificates that are canceled, where the ownership is transferred from one person to another, and it has holes punched in it. But all those can be of value to collectors. And, you know, I always like to stick in great stories. The other week here, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal about lost and found. And this just, again, talks about finding old money. And, you know, sometimes in a case here, a case of lose a certificate. And there was a gentleman back, his name happened to be a Max Hensley, and he was part of, owned a certificate of the Texas Pacific Land Trust. And this was lost and rediscovered, and that it had amassed a handsome fortune. Now, this isn't always the case, but what happened was, the certificate dated all the way back to the days of the Wild West in early 19th century, and when there was railroads from Texas to the Pacific Ocean, and the Texas Pacific Railway Company went broke, though, in 1885 due to bad construction. And then to compensate bondholders, what happened is the owner of the company agreed to transfer rights to what was thought to be worthless land of where coyotes and cactus were in Texas, and so which the bondholders organized into the Texas Pacific Land Trust. So the bondholders got land and didn't have any more of the railroad company. And then investors at that time had an option to exchange their bonds for 100 shares of stock in the land trust. All in the series were exchanged between 1893 and 1902. Now, there was one certificate, certificate number 390 in 1890. It couldn't have been worth more than a few hundred dollars, and it wasn't exchanged. And then in 1920, the Texas Pacific Land Trust discovered that its real estate was on top of a large oil area, and that's when the Texas oil boom started. And then the trust paid dividends to its holders, by that time worth a pretty penny, and then it launched a campaign to find all the rightful owners, or find the rightful owner of that old certificate, 390. You know, and the effort led to legitimate claims and ownership around 1950, so it took this long in the story. And then it wasn't until 1979 that a bank official in California read about, you know, the missing certificate. He recalled seeing it archiving the very paper in a Wells Fargo bank in San Francisco, and the certificate number 390 turned out to have belonged to a deceased turn-of-the-century Dutch sailor, and he had left that estate to a daughter and the medical school of John Hopkins, Harvard, and Columbia, and the estimated value of that old certificate in 1979 turned out to be $4 million. So, you know, there's an old story of a lost certificate that was found. There are companies out there. How do you find out what a company, you know, if you find an old certificate, what is it worth? You can pay a company. There's actually companies out there that you can pay to do the research for you. What I found is they get a percentage of what the value of the certificate is. Now, these companies are very good at what they do. They even track down owners that haven't made claim on old certificates that they have found they're missing, and then they try to collect a pretty penny on these things. So it can be sometimes expensive, but here's what I found. You can negotiate what you pay them, because a lot of times you can go through companies like ours, and we use our research department, and putting it into that, it just takes a little time and effort, and the cost is usually a lot less. Another way to go about researching old certificates is you can go online. You can see what you can find out, whether there's mergers of the companies, has the company been bought out by somebody else. You can go to the library, you know, the Financial Stock Guide service book. It's a great source there. What you need, if you find an old certificate, you need to have proof of the ownership. You know, now that you have to prove that you are the beneficiary of the stock, and each stock has a registered owner, then you must prove you were assigned the right of that security through a will or trust. My job as an advisor would be to help you, you know, we do it free of charge. We can do all the legwork for you. You know, can you get a stock certificate now? Like, if you go out there and buy stocks, can you get a real stock for Disney? You can. You can go on line to ononeshare.com, and you can actually get stock certificates. Most companies, though, are getting away from issuing stock certificates and keeping them in record form on the computer instead of in paper form. And so, yes, you can get things. How about if you lose an old stock certificate or you've lost a stock certificate that's held over time? Well, there is a registry out there that keeps record of everyone who owns the certificate. And what you would have to do is file a law certificate claim form. Again, something we can do, something we can help people out. And you'd have to provide proof who you are, and you'd have to provide proper documentation and forms that the transfer agent would require, and they would replace the stock certificate and make you whole. You know, what else do people find in old, in safe deposit boxes or safes or underwear drawers? We've heard of stores there, or cans in the barn, such as cash. You know, these are all different things that we find out. You know, savings bonds, sometimes if they have matured, you can still cash them in and get money for them. They don't become worthless. They just stop earning interest after time. There's old paper money, you know, from an antique place. Sometimes you can take all this old paper money to a coin shop and see what it's worth and whether you want to keep it or sell it. There's a lot of places, other things that get found in a safety deposit box of old money. What I call finding old money is, you know, gold jewelry. Sometimes you'll find an old insurance report. You know, insurance, sometimes when you have a bank account nowadays, the bank or credit union will automatically put a $2,000 life insurance or death and disability insurance policy on your account free of charge. And a lot of times these are things that get missed when a person passes away.
Hey, Carrie.
Yes.
We can go ahead and take our third break if it's all right with you.
Sounds good, Chris. And listeners, you're listening to WHTC Money Matters. We'll be right back after the short break. Hey, listeners, welcome back. You're listening to WHTC Money Matters. The number here is 395-1450, taking your calls. And we're talking today about finding old money. What is the value of that old money? We've talked about finding old lost stock certificates, and this is a pretty more common than what you think. You know, a lot of times people forget about stock certificates they have. They may have them at their house in a firebox. They may have them in a safety deposit box at their house or at the bank. But there are different ways that people can hold stock certificates. You can hold, as we talked about earlier, the physical stock certificate. You know, the stock certificate is a piece of paper. And, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages to that. So I thought I'd quickly go over that. You know, the advantage of holding the physical certificate, you know, the company that you own the stock in will know where to reach you, where to send the records and information to you directly. You may find it easier to pledge securities as collateral for a loan. And when you want to sell your stock, the disadvantage is when you have to sell that stock, you'll have to send the certificate to your broker or to the company's transfer agent. And this may take time, and it makes it a little harder to sell quickly. And then the other disadvantage, if you lose the certificate, you may be charged a fee to replace that certificate. And then if you move, you'll have to contact the company to change the address. And sometimes this is a common thing that gets forgotten. Sometimes people forget to change the address. So physical certificate. Another way to hold the stock is in what is called street registration. You hold that name in the name of the brokerage firm. So you have a brokerage account, you own the stock, and the brokerage firm holds the stock for you. And there's some definite advantages because the security is already at the broker. You can place orders on that. You can sell it quicker. Your brokerage firm is responsible for safeguarding the securities. And the brokerage firm may keep you informed on important developments such as offers and when bonds are called. And it's easier to set up a margin or borrow on on the security's disadvantage. Sometimes you may experience a slight delay in receiving dividends. Now, in the past, that may have been true. Today, that isn't so. As an advisor in accounts and receiving dividends, we get the dividends the day they're paid, and they are reinvested that same day if they're compounded. Since the name, your name is not on the books of the company will not mail important corporate communications directly to you. What happens is that information comes to a brokerage company. A brokerage company forwards that information on to you. Again, you will get it, just not maybe as fast. And then the third way to hold a stock certificate is through what's called direct registration. The security is registered in the name on the issuer's books, and a transfer agent company holds it for you. So the advantage there is direct registration. They hold the certificate. You don't. And you can buy and sell pretty much quickly doing it that way. You can have dividends reinvested, and you get information quicker. The disadvantage when you go to buy or sell through the direct registration process, you usually don't get that price that very instant. They sell things at the end of the day, usually, and you get the price, whatever the price is at the end of the day, so you're not assured of your price always. And, those are just some of the ways to hold a stock certificate. And what happens if your stock certificate is lost? Brokerage firms, banks, transfer agents, corporations have procedures in place to help you out. And what we do, we don't charge anybody for doing that. So if somebody comes in and say, hey, I have a lost certificate, we will reach out, contact the transfer agent. We would contact them with the proper information, documents, and letter for you. There would have to be signatures obtained, signatures that have to be signature guaranteed, which we're able to do. And then we would also put a stop or on a lost or stolen certificate so nobody else can go out if they have found the old certificate and they're not the rightful owner of it. They can't just go out and sell it. So we can put a stop on things like that. So there's a lot of different things to do. A lot of times there's money out there that gets forgotten about, investments that get forgotten about, companies change names, gets passed down from generation to generation. There's also a website at the state level, and I'm not sure of that website name, but I think if you go to the state website, there is a part in there for lost or unclaimed property. And unclaimed property could include land, stock certificates, life insurance claims. Sometimes you could reach out there and do a search to find out if there's something that has not been claimed and is under a relative or your parents' name. And there's things like that that get found. Now, like I mentioned earlier, you can pay companies to do that, but those are some of the areas where I would start.
All right, Kerry, that's all we have time for today.
All right, listeners, hey, thanks for listening on the snowy January morning. Thank you for listening to WHTC Money Matters. Our next week's topic is tax planning for 2014, what you need to do this year. So that will be February 1st. Again, have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to WHTC Money Matters. This is Kerry Cooley.
You've been listening to WHTC Money Matters with your hosts, Jack Godfrey and Kerry Cooley from the Cooley Godfrey Investment Group of Zealand. The opinions voiced in this show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial advisor, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC.